guys, and welcome to episode 183 of the OCDstories.com podcast. Now, in this episode, I got on Dr. Stephen Phillipson to talk about magical thinking and thought action fusion. So in this, Stephen goes back to the start and explains what is OCD, kind of what's going on in the brain. And then he starts to explain what is magical thinking, how magical thinking exists generally in society, ERP or exposures for magical thinking. We go into thought action fusion, and then Stephen gets some words of hope and much, much more. Hopefully you'll find this useful if you deal with magical thinking. Thanks to Steve and you guys for listening. And without further ado, here he is.
Welcome back to the show, Steve.
It's good to see you again.
Yeah.
Good to You're looking you. Well, Stu.
Thank you. So what is magical thinking?
I've been giving a lot of thought this past week or so to the topic of magical thinking. And before I actually speak about the specifics of magical thinking as a subset of OCD, I want to just review some of the broader concepts of OCD so that talking about magical thinking within that, I think, has more context and more relevance. And the first thing I want to say is, you know, magical thinking is just one of the endless multitude of subsets of OCD. And the more that the internet is propagating information about OCD, I'm always amused at the addition of the new letters before the OCD. As we know, the HOCD for gay spiking, ROCD for relationship OCD, POCD for pedophile, HOCD for harm. And so magical thinking, you know, or maybe we call it MOCD. Let's see if you and I can invent some new letters within the OCD spectrum today, Stu. But you know, that MOCD or magical thinking OCD is just yet one more of the array, the endless array of the OCD subsets. I think of the little subsets as being valuable because people can share and relate and feel more of a sense of a camaraderie to know that they're not the only ones on this planet who are having these types of thoughts, and that there are a whole multitude of people with OCD that get anxious and upset about thoughts about being sexually attracted to children, and that a lot of these topics have a tremendous amount of shame, you know, built around it. I was thinking one of my favorite spike themes is perhaps a mother who might have sexual thoughts about her own daughter, because within that one spike, oh, maybe I'm going to molest my own child, you have pedophile OCD, you have HOCD if it's a female child, and you have IOCD, incest OCD, right? So within one spike, you have these three different subsets. And so it just sort of speaks about kind of, you know, the meaninglessness of the different permutations of OCD. So I wanted to say also, in terms of OCD in the broad condition, that basically OCD has these three components. There's a very clear biochemical component where the brain, the machine, is sparking and malfunctioning and sending this emotional distress signal. We call it anxiety, and that the person experiences physiologically a very powerful wave of overwhelming distress that's extremely attention-getting and extremely compelling to find a solution to this biochemical experience. And so OCD without a theme is just called panic. It's the idea that there's something happening within my body that says there's a problem, there's a major malfunction, and I am overwhelmed to figure out how can I get back to homeostasis? How can I feel better again? Because my heart racing, my stomach getting anxious and upset, my mind racing, my palms sweating, just to name very few of the experiences of anxiety, are very unpleasant, and they're very, very distressing, and they're very, very compelling and attention getting. So there's a physiological component to OCD. OCD then takes it a step further, and then there's a cognitive component typically. The cognitive component is what we just spoke about in terms of the endless nature of the creative thoughts. So the thought about being sexually inappropriate with a child, the thought about possibly being gay, the thought about maybe I just disrespected God, the thought about violence. So, you know, the big three of OCD are sex, violence, and religion. Those are the three most common clusters. But obviously, that those big three were made up about 20 years ago. So we really need a new statistic on, now that we understand the greater variety of OCD. You know, it probably isn't just the big three anymore. It's probably more like the big 100. And I'm always fantasizing about writing an article on every spike theme that I have encountered, because they are profoundly diverse and profoundly kind of endlessly creative. So we have the physiological malfunction, and then we have the neocortex, meaning the thinking brain, pairing the physiological dysfunction with a cognition. And the cognition is typically extraordinarily irrational, meaningless, and yet it feels so real. And so people without OCD have exactly that second component, the cognition, without the emotional component. And so the third component is the brain keeper voice. And so I'm always having patients become very, very aware of and encouraging them to be very disciplined to separate out the voice from the brain, which is what we call an automatic association, to how us, the gatekeeper, the autonomous being, can respond to that brain voice. And this has become more and more in my practice and in part of the treatment package, I think, a huge component. And patients push back and they say, but it's all me, you know, it's all one brain. I am my brain. And I say that's very false thinking, because just as you are not your digestive acids in your stomach, you are not the person keeping our body regulated at 98.6 Fahrenheit. You'll have to tell me, Stu, what is the body temperature in Celsius?
I do not know.
You don't know? Okay. Well, when you take a thermometer, if you think you have a fever, what's the body temperature?
I don't know.
Really?
Well, when I you didn't have do well at science.
You're going to become aware, because if they have a fever, you're going to know exactly what that number is. Anyway, so yeah. the brain machine obviously regulates a tremendous amount of functions in our physiology. But this is the part that gets really fuzzy for people. The brain machine also can produce a voice. So if I stub my toe, my brain machine says to me, "You clumsy idiot." And it's just a reflex. It's a mental thought reflex that there's no Steve in, because Steve does not consider himself clumsy, nor does Steve consider himself an idiot. Some aspects of life, yes, but not as a general conclusion. So we can acknowledge that the brain voice sends us a signal, and that the gatekeeper us has the freedom and the opportunity to respond to that brain signal. And that's the entire basis of treatment, is the idea that we can choose to react to the brain functioning in a way that neutralizes it and demonstrates its irrelevance. It's funny, because people, like, if I stand on a balcony or if I'm standing on a train tracks, my brain voice says to me, "Jump," almost all the time. Now, there's nothing about Steve that's suicidal. I'm not depressed. And the idea of ending my life is certainly not a priority or anything I'm incentivized to do. And so it's easy to say, I have the thought to jump off a balcony. But I would encourage people to detract from the sense of saying, I have the thought, as opposed to saying, my brain just shared the thought of jumping off the balcony. Because when we separate voice, we can easily say, and I say to that brain voice, "Hey, thanks for sharing. no big deal. Persons with OCD, when their brain says, jump off the balcony, might experience, once again, the pairing of the emotional distress signal. So this is just kind of a foundation of how we work with any particular spike theme, and particularly with things such as magical thinking. So any on that topic, Stu, is there anything that you wanted to ask about, anything you want for clarification of? Because this is, for all facets of treating OCD, to me, a huge basis that that treatment is predicated on, is or we might call the mind being aware and separating out brain voice, brain experience, and then gatekeepers' management of that.
No, that made a lot of sense. I think I need to get my head around it. But yeah, that was a good introduction.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that when we practice that mental discipline, the mental mindfulness of looking at what my brain is sharing, and then we have the opportunity to respond in a way that demonstrates our autonomy, our values, and our education about neutralizing the brain's energy by disregard, that's really a critical part of the treatment process and ultimately freedom.
Yeah, one thing that came up for me was when you were talking about kind of jumping in front of the train on the platform or jumping off a balcony, like most people get those thoughts, right?
Yeah.
And I certainly get them at the London Underground. If I'm too near the edge, my brain would kind of push me in, figuratively.
Yeah.
And as I'm not suicidal, it's not an OCD thing for me, it's just my brain. But it's a good example for intrusive thoughts. If someone gets the thought of hurting their child, but then that thought comes up 100 times within a minute, so to speak, and maybe the anxiety's there, they're then kind of, what am I trying to say here? It becomes very real. It's harder for them to say, my brain is doing X, because it's far easier for them to go, I want to hurt my child, or what if I want to hurt my child?
Right. And the thing is that it really kind of demonstrates that OCD, the entirety of the condition is predicated on the malfunctioning amygdala, because you exactly have a thought of jumping in front of the train, but without the distress signal, it's very easy for you to be dismissive of it.
Yeah.
So the distress signal for all facets of OCD is what gives it the life and energy that makes people very compelled to figure out that they're not really at risk, excuse me, or that they're not capable, or that they're not going to harm their own child. And so people work to prove their innocence or their lack of capability of engaging in that behavior. And obviously that effort turns into fuel for the condition, and it enhances the brain's sense that, oh, there must be a problem. That's legitimate because, oh, look, this person is acting so desperately to neutralize it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
So magical thinking in particular is a subset of OCD in which the sufferer perpetuates the belief that they possess magical control over their ability to influence conditions that affect themselves or others. And most likely is the idea of that if I knock on wood, that safety, you know, will follow. And magical thinking also might involve the idea that if I have the thought of getting in a car accident driving home, that sends out a kind of signal to the universe that now the conditions will be altered in some way, that I'm at much greater risk of getting into that car accident. Mm. And so magical thinking is basically the idea that thoughts create a potential, or even words create a potential to influence kind of the ethos of one's future or one's safety.
Yeah.
Persons, I think, often can have magical thinking be perpetuated by, if you think about a lot of religious ideas, like if I pray to God, then God might change the future, change circumstances to our favor. And so I think a lot of religious practices kind of perpetuate the idea of magical thinking, or even I think it says in the New Testament that an impure thought is almost as tantamount to an impure action. And so with magical thinking, the idea that if I have a thought of harming a loved one, that that might create, or a loved one being harmed, that now puts that person at greater risk. And so it's this fusion of the idea being an influence in the probability of events happening. Things that are under the magical thinking paradigm might be, you know, that old saying, you know, I'm not sure if it exists in England, you know, step on a crack, break your mother's back.
Yeah, it does.
England have that saying?
Yeah, we do, unfortunately.
There you go. Well, I think it's, I remember it as a cute, as a kid, it was kind of cute. And then I would step on the crack. But the idea is that by behaving in this way, once again, it has this magical influence on someone else's safety. Other things that are common forms of magical thinking that OCD can kind of co-opt and take over are like a superstitious thought, like if you break a mirror, something bad will happen. I had a patient once who had exactly this form of OCD, and he performed an exposure exercise. We did break a mirror on purpose, and within the next week, he was held up. He was mugged. His mom had a fire in her apartment, and there was a I forget what, but another negative event that happened. And he came back, and he literally blamed me for those events happening as a result of us breaking the mirror together. So another form of magical thinking involves something like, say, knocking on wood, as if that one, that creates some magical shield of protection. And a lot of people with magical thinking, their brains send them associations such that numbers have some significance. A favorite number is the number like 6 is perhaps the devil's number, or even numbers are good and odd numbers are bad. Number 13 obviously is the big unlucky number. And this is sort of one of my favorites because I was born on June 6th and my name has 6 letters in it. So I love 3 sixes. Even though some people consider 3 sixes the sign of the devil. Another form of magical thinking that also exists common in real life is in the Asian practice of something called feng shui. It's the idea that we can arrange objects in a room to produce greater energy. You know, so people engage in placing objects sometime in their lucky spot or even in their lucky direction. Like if I were to place a pen on a desk, if it faces north, then that kind of is good and that's kind of protective. Other people might engage in putting on their shoes in a particularly ritualized way to kind of create good energy for the rest of the day. Putting your right shoe on first is the right way to do it, is the safe way. And even going back to the idea of stepping through a threshold, if I go through a threshold with my right foot first, then I'm keeping things safe for what's going to happen in the next room. So these are kind of some of the more typical examples. Let's see. So, you know, with ERP, with the treatment of magical thinking, it's really basically like all other facets of ERP, where we encourage patients to behave in a way that sort of creates the unlucky response. So having persons place pens in the dark or the dangerous direction, having patients put on left shoe first. Or even having patients say things like, when I said once, dark forces of the universe, come and get me, kind of sending the signal out into the universe. Or, hey, I hope this week my daughter gets in a car accident and gets a broken leg. You know, once again, sending out this danger signal. And it's funny, a lot of people, even when they don't have OCD, have a really hard time saying these kind of curses, as it were, putting on curses to innocent others. I always find that very, very amusing. I have no qualms about saying something like, oh, I hope I die of cancer within the next 6 months, you know, or, you know, please God, or please Buddha, you know, please give me terminal cancer within the next 6 months. You know, I have difficulty getting into the universe, but it's kind of funny to me that a lot of people, whether they have OCD or not, you know, have a bit of a difficult time with that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a very good point. And you're right, the general population couldn't say something like that. And especially in England, like you say, there's a lot of superstition around, as you said, about the crack earlier, walking under a ladder. Yeah. We have these three kind of manhole covers in a row. I don't know why. But yeah, if you kind of go across three of them, that's bad luck. So you often find people walk across two, hop the third or hop the first, and knock on wood. You know, I find myself doing that, and I wouldn't say it's an OCD thing for me, but I still feel odd not doing it. So maybe that's something I'll stop doing now.
Yeah, and it's funny because when you know, the general population gives into these what I might call silly superstitions, generally we're talking about deviating our life path for about 3 seconds. Obviously, with OCD, the need to secure safety becomes an endless, you know, array of fragilities.
Yeah.
A lot of people, I was thinking, you know, engage in a lot of avoidance with this idea. Like a lot of my patients who have the idea that if I have a violent thought, then my chances of engaging in violent behavior is exponentially increased. And so they will often avoid watching the news, because if a news story comes up about some violent event, that they're like, oh, now that I'm thinking about it, there's more of a risk for that happening to me or a loved one. People will often avoid movies that have, you know, violent scenes in it or scenes that involve superstition. And so obviously there can become a lot of fragility in trying to keep one's thought process or one's environment, you know, kind of metaphysically pure, as it were.
Yeah, that makes sense. And you mentioned there, obviously, about the believing the thought is as powerful as the action. That being thought action fusion. Is that kind of the?
That's exactly right. I want to talk about that in just just 1 second.
Yep.
I was also thinking about the idea of, you know, the thought of hurting my girlfriend. Oh wow, I'm just as guilty now as if I actually did it. Like the idea that having the thought is in and of itself, because it's once again coming from the me brain, and people not separating brain voice from me voice, me the autonomous gatekeeper, that people live within the illusion that the brain and the brain's voices are a conglomeration of a single entity, a single identity. The idea of, like, even the thought of, like, you know, God damn it. Oh, my God, I just had that thought. God damn it. Now God's been offended because I had the thought. Now I need to do some prayers to undo that negative energy, you know, being put out into, you know, the heavens, as it were. Also, I was talking a little bit about ERP. I think one of the biggest misnomers of ERP is this idea that patients might learn that over time, by doing exposure exercises, that they will see the irrational nature of the their associations. And I think that's a misnomer, that the goal of ERP isn't to say, oh, look, this actually isn't risky, because the most people who have OCD are aware in the world of rational thinking that these associations are meaningless, bizarre, and irrational. It's just, once again, that the brain is so compelling because it infuses a experience of legitimacy. And so people are behaving in these desperate ways to remove themselves or minimize the experience of the risk factor. And so it's really important to keep in mind that the goal of ERP is to decondition the brain's physiological fragility and the brain's powerful malfunctioning signals. It's not really to attend to the rational, irrational component of these thoughts. So now to thought action fusion, which is sort of a subset within magical thinking. Thought action fusion is the idea that simply having the thought makes it more likely that that might occur, that the thought might come to fruition. You know, once again, if I have a thought of having a car accident, that the chances of that happening are greater. And a lot of people with what's called TAF, thought action fusion, are very, very kind of fragile in trying to protect or control where their mind wanders to. And that fragility, you know, can produce a lot of what's called thought suppression. This idea that we want to kind of keep our brain from acting in this kind of spontaneous way. And so if you think about the way the brain works, since it is capable of generating thoughts in a way that we can't control, and I refer to that in my choice articles, one of the independent systems, that our mind is able to produce a thought with our having no control over it whatsoever, this idea of thought suppression then creates a boomerang effect where the brain reacts even a more strong way, and the brain produces a lot more desperation, a lot more power to having the thought, because now the thought has been tagged as being inappropriate or unacceptable.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Yeah, and you can see why that then makes it feel more powerful.
I was just reminded, a lot of people with thought action fusion become very tormented by what might be an immoral thought. That's another. There are sort of two subsets of thought action fusion. One is the idea of the likelihood of the thought producing a shift in probability. The other is the idea that having the thought of something against God is tantamount to that negative event being now a reflection on their personhood. So there's often a large component of guilt with thought action fusion. And keep in mind that OCD, even though it's an anxiety disorder, it can really naturally spawn one of five emotional conditions, one being anxiety, the second one being guilt, third being anger, the fourth being disgust, and the fifth being, I'm having a brain freeze, let's see, anxiety, guilt, anger, disgust, and depression. That's it.
Yeah,
that a spike can produce depression. Like sometimes people will have a spike, oh, you're a horrible person, and then a person will actually feel depressed and they'll feel compelled to undo the depression. So yeah, those five emotions, anxiety, guilt, depression, anger, and disgust are the big five that the OCD produce. But so with this moral thought action fusion is the idea that, once again, oh, by having a thought about violence or a thought about immoral religiosity, that speaks about one's character, and that creates this association that, once again, the thought is as bad as acting on the crime. An interesting case that I had where thought action fusion actually came true, and I've seen this a number of times, is I had a patient who was a very competent basketball player. And in college, while he was at the free throw line, that's where if a penalty happens, you get to take a shot at the basket. And usually really good basketball players can hit that shot at about 70 to 80%. But when he would be at the line for his free throw, his brain would say to him, "You're going to miss the free throw." And then he would actually miss the free throw. And so here you've got thought action fusion, where the feared thought actually takes place. And there are elements where performance can affect outcome. Another perfect example is the idea of laying on your bed and your brain says, "You're not going to go to sleep now." And so when we to contradict the warning, right? So when we put in effort, so for him to say, his brain says, "Oh, you're going to miss the three throw." And now he tries harder to make the three throw, or the brain says, "You're not going to sleep," and you try harder to sleep. Well, the impact of that greater effort turns into a greater likelihood of failure. So that almost goes back to a discussion we had prior in terms of a two-tailed spike. You know, what do? You have to kind of just embrace the potential negative consequence and not put an effort on controlling it or getting it right.
Yeah, no, that's fascinating. That makes a lot of sense. Okay, so is there anything else you want to say on that before I go on to my next question?
I think I'm ready for your next question.
Okay, good. So thought action fusion and magical thinking seem very similar to me. As you said, they're kind of interlinked. So what does, you know, let's say I have magical thinking, what would ERP look like for me?
It would involve, like most ERP, coming up with a hierarchy. Where you might say, you know, "Okay, universe, I want my child to have a cold within the next week," you know, and then the next step would be, "Okay, universe, I want my child to have pneumonia within the next week," to, "Okay, universe, please give my child lung cancer within the next week." So a person can increasingly demonstrate to their brain that they're not going to be fragile about the topics that the brain has infused with this distress signal that contradicts. So, you know, a person might have a hierarchy of being disrespectful to God, you know, or a person might have a hierarchy of placing objects in greater degrees of negative outcome positions.
Yeah, no, that makes sense.
And once again, keep in mind that it's not that we're showing the person, "Oh, look, my son didn't catch a cold this week, therefore this isn't true." It's that, hey, I'm willing to activate the brain's distress signal or warning signal and demonstrate the irrelevance of that signal.
Okay, yeah. So you're almost not looking for the new learning. You're going to get that anyway, but you're not looking for that. It's just trying to hit that fire alarm and then not care.
And as I said, for most people with OCD, there's not really new learning required, because deep down they'll mostly say, "I know this is ridiculous," but once again, the feeling component of the condition is what compels, you know, these very rational, very logical people to behave in ways that make it look like they're endorsing the kind of superstitious or magical thinking, but they're just really, as all forms of OCD, just behaving in a way that coincides with the distress signal, because that distress signal is 100% authentic. You would feel no different, you know, facing a spike emotion as you would if you were just about to be bit by a cobra snake, because the brain doesn't differentiate at that biological level, you know, real danger versus fake danger. You feel the authenticity of the danger, so you're damn well going to behave as if you need to escape that.
Good illustration. Okay, so let's say someone has, this is a question I kind of developed off someone's email. So for those that have magical rules, kind of, I say rules here, but magical thinking in almost many areas of their life, it seems, you know, it's just gone everywhere. Will starting to tackle one part affect the rules in the other part, in the sense of if you just start tackling one area, will you see a loosening in the other areas, or do you have to nothing else will change until you go to those specific areas, if that makes sense?
Yeah, that's a really good question. It's funny because let's say someone has magical thinking and they have contamination OCD. So if you do a hierarchy within magical thinking, like, okay, I have to shampoo my hair first in order to make the day safe. And if I shampoo my, if I wash my feet first, then the day's going to be threatened, right? So if you do aggressive work within one facet of magical thinking, the chances are that the benefit will generalize to other magical thinking themes. However, it will probably not touch the contamination OCD. So, but that's a really, really good question. I mean, if you succeed with magical thinking and a person starts behaving more according to their autonomous agenda rather than the magical thinking rules or protection guidelines, you're developing kind of a mental momentum that you can carry over to the contamination OCD. So that treatment might be more expedited by the success within magical thinking. But if you get rid of magical thinking, the contamination OCD basically will not be changed in any way.
Yeah, no, that's interesting, and I can see why. So similar, is ERP enough to break the link of thought action fusion, or does it require something else?
That's a really good question. Can you give me an example? So if a person has thought action fusion and they're doing aggressive exposure therapy that demonstrates that they're not going to be complicit with their brain's concepts of, oh, having the thought is tantamount to taking the action. What other components are you asking me about?
I'm not sure. I just thought I'd ask that to kind of say, is it, it will yeah, will doing the exposures and the response prevention kind of alone kind of break that link almost of I'm having this thought, therefore that means this bad thing will happen.
I mean, generally speaking, I would say yes. There are some aspects of OCD which are a bit less inclined to respond to ERP alone, but I don't want to mention those because it will spike the hell out of about half of your listeners.
Okay, cool. All right, well, let's leave that there.
Even my saying this alone is going to spike
I
the hell
know,
out
yeah. All
of
right, swiftly moving on.
you. Like, what is it? What is
Yeah.
it?
Okay, so what words of hope do you have for someone who has magical thinking or thought action fusion?
Yeah, the good news is that this is no different, as I said in the beginning of today's discussion, from any other subset of OCD. Persons with thought action fusion that involves a subset, what I call responsibility OCD, where they need to protect others, right? So in that regard, they're dealing both with the anxiety component, but guilt is also a potentially very powerful manipulator of behavior. Just interesting, I had a patient who took Prozac who had responsibility OCD, meaning the anxious and guilt manipulated need to protect others. Her own safety was not at all part of her OCD, but keeping others safe was the major component. And when she took the Prozac, her anxiety completely went away. But the guilt of being this bad person, if she didn't engage in the rituals, was just as powerful. And so she didn't derive any treatment benefit from taking Prozac, even though she had no anxiety. The guilt was just as strong a manipulator of her ritualizing. So, you know, words of hope is to understand that you're probably going to have to deal with the anxiety component of magical thinking or the thought action fusion, but also deal with the guilt component. And sometimes guilt is a manifestation of an idea about protecting one's image or protecting one's sense of goodness as a person. And so one of the tenets of cognitive therapy is the idea that there are no such things as good or bad people. Now, that's just as controversial as what we spoke about before in the world of are there answers or no answers in the universe. And so for OCD, often the idea of taking one's identity or one's image can be just as manipulating as ridding oneself of the physiological anxiety. And that's a very, I think, often not well discussed subset of OCD, the idea that if I don't perform the ritual, that means I'm a bad person. If I have thoughts about harming my child, that means I'm a bad person. Bad people have these thoughts. And so the idea of protecting one's sense of identity, you know, I want to hold the good person trophy. You know, who doesn't want to possess the good person trophy? That becomes very influential in substantiating a person's sense of need to perform rituals. And so that might be a topic for down the road, how believing in being good or bad, or believing in the potential for our goodness to vary from day to day based on whether we comply with rituals or not, or whether we give in to spikes or not. Because for a lot of people, there's a lot of effort put into with OCD, I need to not lose my good person trophy.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so is there anything else on magical thinking or thought action fusion that you want to share?
I think I've emptied the cauldron for the moment on those two topics. If there's any aspect of them that you think might deserve some light, I'd be happy to address that.
Cool. Nothing comes to mind at the minute, but obviously if anything does, I'll bring it up in a future episode.
Okay.
And then lastly is, what do you wish you had known when you started out?
Okay. You really want me to answer that? So when I started as a clinician, I thought it was really important to show my patients that I was competent, and I thought it was important to show my patients that I was skilled clinician, that my initial goal was to demonstrate that they were in good hands. Mm-hmm. And so effort was put in initially to kind of demonstrating that evidence of being competent and that they've made a correct choice in seeing me. This is, by the way, is 30 years ago, Stu. So we're not talking yesterday.
Yeah.
So over time and losing many, many patients while trying to show them how amazing I was as a clinician, I discovered that the goal of my role is not to demonstrate my competence, but to do nothing more than to discover what's going on in their world, to be a really good detective, and to be very, very invested in what I say is drawing a very high resolution picture of their life, their circumstances, and also in treating the entire human rather than how I started out as a behaviorist, really treating specific symptoms.
Yeah.
And so it took me not too long of a time to discover that the therapeutic alliance, the working bond between myself and the patient in really developing a very close attachment and a very mutually invested relationship was really the heart of what all great therapy is predicated on. And it's not about showing someone they've made the right choice and Dr. Phillipson's the person to see.
Yeah.
So long-winded answer, but to a very valuable lesson that I learned for myself and I try to impart on my staff, that my staff often says, I don't feel like I'm helping my patients. And I say right away, that's not our goal. Our goal is to collaborate and work with them. It's not really to help them.
Yeah, good point. Yeah, I like that. That was interesting. Well, look, thank you for talking about magical thinking. It's a topic that several people have asked me to do. So, yeah, thanks.
It's my pleasure. I hope we've covered a sufficient amount of it.
Yeah, I'm sure we have.
So there you have it. I hope you enjoyed my episode with Steve. And if you want to hear more of the episodes I've done with him, if you go to theocdstories.com, go to the show notes of this episode. I'll put links to all those other episodes. And quick disclaimer, guys, this podcast is not therapy. It's not a replacement for therapy. Please seek treatment from a trained professional. Until we speak, take care.